Hi, I'm Carmen LaBerge. Here's the podcast for Connecting Faith. Enjoy the conversation.
Real conversations about how we live out our faith every day. Welcome to Connecting Faith.
Hello, friends. Welcome to Connecting Faith. It is October 31, 2018. I don't know if you're celebrating Halloween today. I don't know if you are celebrating this is the day of Reformation. 501 years ago today, Martin Luther nailed the 95 Theses to the door in Wittenberg. And a little shout out here to Franklin Classical School teacher, Mr. Scherer, who yesterday nailed 95 Reese's to his classroom door. And any student who could name one of Luther's 95 Theses could take one of the 95 Reese's. So I don't know. Maybe this is a way of redeeming Halloween. We're going to talk in a moment about Halloween, its pagan nature. We're also going to talk about All Hallows Eve. Tomorrow is All Saints Day. We're going to talk a little bit about the Day of the Dead. But before we do that, I want to talk. I want to give God all the glory and the praise. I want to also give a shout out to everyone who has been involved in this particular case. I'm talking about Asia Beebe. Asia Beebe is a woman, 53 years old. Since 2009, she has been incarcerated. She's been on death row since 2010 in Pakistan. And today, Wednesday, October the 31st, the Pakistan's highest court, which is their Supreme Court, ordered her released. Asia Beebe is a poor, illiterate Christian. She's the mother of five. She had been sentenced to death for committing what is, under their law, considered blasphemy. And it will be interesting to see if she now escapes Pakistan with her life. That is certainly our prayer. We're going to talk about where she might go. I frankly think she should come to the United States of America, because if she goes to Europe, frankly, the action of their Court of Human Rights just last week would lead us to believe that blasphemy laws there are getting almost are almost as bad in terms of your freedom of speech as other places in the world. So the Supreme Court of Pakistan overturned the conviction against Asia Beebe, who was accused in 2009 of insulting the Prophet Muhammad. A little context here. She is a very poor person, and she was working as a farmhand with other women in rural Pakistan. She was ordered to get water while harvesting fruit in a field. And when she returned with the bucket of water and dipped her cup into the bucket of water that she had just retrieved, there were Muslim women present who complained that Asia Beebe dipped her cup in the water because as a non-Muslim, they regarded her as unclean. This led to some kind of quarrel. And her co-workers then accused her of insulting the Prophet Muhammad. She was beaten. The women went on to complain to a religious leader in the community, who then pressed for these blasphemy charges. And blasphemy carries a death sentence under Pakistani law. And so, having been convicted and sentenced to death in November 2010, she's basically been in solitary confinement. They would argue for her own protection, but solitary confinement nonetheless for the last 8 years. Pope Benedict and later Pope Francis are among the world leaders who have called for her release. Virtually every human rights and civil rights effort and organization under the sun has been engaged and involved in hoping for this day. And Beebe told the American Foreign Press, the AFP, that she said, "I can't believe what I'm hearing. I just don't even know what to say. I'm very happy, but I cannot believe it." We certainly look forward to hearing more of her testimony. The United States Commission on International Religious Freedom, obviously among those groups celebrating the decision, also urging now Pakistani officials to take steps to not only ensure Asia Bibi's safety and safe exodus from the country, but also calling for the release of another 40 people who remain on death row in Pakistan under similar charges. So we talk a little bit about blasphemy laws. Blasphemy laws are laws designed to do what? I think theoretically they're designed to protect religious groups, particular religions, or maybe religions in general. But they're definitely designed to protect entire religions rather than the rights of any given individual. And so if we're going to talk about international human rights and we're going to talk about individual rights, the right of a freedom of the conscience and the expression of your conscience via freedom of speech would seem to be one of the most significant international, or, you know, basic human rights. I mean, certainly we here in the United States of America regard that as an inalienable right bestowed to us by our Creator. And so you and I, we feel free to say whatever we want about whatever we want to whomever we want in pretty much any tone or manner we want. And if you need any sort of evidence of that, you could simply, watch videos on social media today of how people have been expressing themselves on the corners and curbs of Pittsburgh in relationship to the visit there of the president, who is seeking to tend to the grief of a community of people who were targeted because of their religion. We have degraded in our civil discourse where I think that it's difficult for people to even measure how much we should be saying and certainly how we should be saying it, because the rhetoric has gotten so mean and the tone so awful. So I want to lift up to you, in case you're not aware, that in Europe last Thursday, the European Court of Human Rights upheld an Austrian court conviction of a woman accused of defaming Muhammad. And so when we talk about what just took place in Pakistan and we talk about what's taking place in Europe, trust me when I tell you, it's going to lead you to furrow your brow. Now, according to the court ruling, the woman in this case, Mrs. S, held several seminars. This is, again, Austria, talking about Europe, held several seminars entitled Basic Information on Islam between 2008 and 2009. And in these seminars, she made several statements regarding Muhammad's marriage to Aisha, which, by the way, Aisha was 6 at the time of their marriage and 9 at the time of consummation. So you can imagine what might have been said in the context of a seminar where that information was shared with people who didn't know it for the first time. There was an undercover journalist who reported on the comments of Mrs. S made during this Basic Information on Islam seminar in 2008 and 2009, and the Vienna Regional Criminal Court found her, quote, guilty of publicly disparaging an object of veneration of a domestic church or religious society, namely Muhammad, the prophet of Islam, in a manner capable of arousing justified indignation. Well, the European Court of Human Rights has now upheld that conviction. And so I think that when we talk about what we're willing to do in appeasement, in terms of appeasement, and what we're willing to do in terms of assimilation, we got to find our way through this conversation about free speech and freedom of speech and rhetoric, and then what's actually going to be permissible in terms of our cultural conversations with one another. All right, friends, I got to take a quick break. Coming up next, a conversation with David Gushy and Colin Holtz about moral leadership in a divided age. Doesn't that sound tasty? Moral leadership in a divided age. Timely topic to be sure. I'm Carmen LaBurge. You're listening to Connecting Faith. friends. Welcome back to Connecting Faith. Joining me now are David Gushy and Colin Holtz. Both of these men are theologically educated and widely published across a number of platforms. David is a professor, author, and frequent voice raised in the ethical conversations of our day. Colin is a writer for The Guardian, a 10-year veteran of political issues advocacy, and they came together to write Moral Leadership for a Divided Age, 14 People Who Dared to Change Our World. Gentlemen, welcome to Connecting Faith.
Thanks for having us, Carmen.
Absolutely.
Yes,
so, Colin, let me start with you. What led the two of you to write this book?
Well, I think we each had our own journey, and I'll let David speak to his. But I had been involved for years in this question of how do you go about transforming the society around you? And as I came deeper and deeper into my faith and a journey that eventually led me to seminary, part of my question was what role do Christians play in changing the communities around them and the world around them? What role do people of faith of all walks play in that same journey? How do those areas of their lives intersect, and what is the right balance? And so when David approached me with the possibility of doing this book together, I was very intrigued because many of the folks you encounter in this book were wrestling with the exact same dilemmas that I was in my personal vocation.
So, David, we'll pitch the same question to you. What were maybe the things going on in the culture or going on in your own experience that led you to want to write this book?
That's a great question, Carmen. At one level, this is a book that I had been kind of thinking about for 20 years because I've been teaching a class on great moral leaders for 20 years in different settings, and there never was exactly the right textbook. And so that was one thing, just the teaching side. But I would say, I share the sense that a lot of people have right now that that there's a lack of great moral leaders, a lack of role models. And in our divisions, one way to say it is that we don't agree on any role models or moral heroes. Maybe the left has theirs and the right has theirs, but there doesn't seem to be anybody that everybody admires. And I envisioned a book that would be unifying and would be inspiring and could maybe help bring people together.
So I was intrigued when I opened it. I was particularly intrigued by the timeline. I love the way that you don't just tell us when these people lived or when they died, but you help us really see how over the course of a couple of centuries, there were individuals who genuinely impacted what we now know to be the course of human history. And I'm wondering, were there others who you considered including in the book who didn't make the list? And friends, again, let me remind you, we're talking about Moral Leadership for a Divided Age, 14 People Who Dared to Change Our World, and we're talking with the co-authors, David Gushy and Colin Holtz. David, I'll let you take this question. Were there other people who you considered who didn't make the list?
Yes. Having taught the class for 20 years, you might say that the semester sets the limit of the number of people you can study, so basically one a week, so 14. So it's like an all-star team. Who gets on your all-star team of 14? And, over 20 years, my list evolved and changed, and there were some people who, would have made the list if I had written the book 5 years ago. One of them was Alexander Solzhenitsyn, the great Russian dissident. I taught about him for years. At one point, the Burmese leader, Aung San Suu Kyi, was going to make the list, but now everything's a mess in Myanmar, and hardly anybody would put her on such a list now. But in fact, part of what's been fun in talking with students about this is who really qualifies as a moral leader, and what do you have to do to get in this group of 14? Some people are already suggesting we should have a sequel, kind of the next 14. There is no canonical list, but it's kind of fun arguing about it,
So I was going to suggest that the immoral list might be fun, too.
great immoral leaders of history. There would be plenty to be learned from the great immoral leaders of history as well. That's for sure.
There would be. Colin, I'm gonna ask you to define moral leadership here in just a minute, but I'd love to give our listeners a sense of how the book opens. So bear with me as I read a couple of the introductory paragraphs from Moral Leadership for a Divided Age. In early January 1920, 12 men sat in a jail condemned to die. A few months before, they and other poor black tenant farmers from Elaine, Arkansas, had met at a local church to organize against the outrageously low prices for cotton the white owners of their land insisted upon. The farmers posted armed guards outside for fear of retaliation. As they assembled that night, there was a rapid burst of gunshots. No one knows who fired first, but a local white man lay dead in the aftermath. The horrific backlash arrived the next day. In one of the bloodier events in U.S. history, gangs of furious whites, stoked by false rumors of unprovoked murder and an impending black uprising, burned the church to the ground, confiscated property, and attacked, beat, arrested, and murdered scores of people. In the aftermath, dozens of sharecroppers faced time in prison. A jury sentenced 12 of them, accused of murder, despite scant evidence, to die in the electric chair after only 6 minutes of deliberation. I think that there are going to be a number of people who are going to be genuinely shocked when they read those opening paragraphs, because somewhere in the American mind, things like that just didn't happen, after slavery came to an end. People seem to be completely unaware of the entire period of history that you're talking about there, really between the emancipation and the civil rights movement. And so I'm interested to know sort of why you guys chose to lead with that. And then, Colin, if you'll just define for us moral leadership.
Yeah, I'd be happy to. And I can speak briefly to both questions. That story always stuck out of me, in part because it's about Ida B. Wells Barnett. And she is one of these fantastic leaders who I have admired and who I came to really admire as we went through the book. It also touches on one of the other important issues that's at play in this book, which is this question of studying history. We're not just studying lives who are divorced from the time and the place in which they lived. We're using those lives to explore history. And as Christians, we can do that and learn a lot about our faith, because we learn about how other Christians or people of other faiths at different times understood how their faith worked in the world. They had different theological ideas, different belief systems, different practices. And we can learn a lot from that study of history that can inform our own lives today. Just as you mentioned, when we have these glaring blind spots, we run into some trouble. On the question of moral leadership, you look at Ida, for example. We have some clear examples of what leadership is. One that always jumps to mind is like General Patton, especially that famous scene from that movie where he's standing in front of a giant flag. So you have this strong, dominant leader. And what we discover is that leadership can appear in lots of different ways, in lots of different facets of life, and you don't have to be a president or a general to be a leader. Most leaders require a set of followers, because if you have people who aren't willing to listen to you, you're just not going to get anywhere. Most leaders require a goal, because you're not just uniting those followers around you for the cult of personality, but because of some vision of where you want to go. And in the case of moral leaders, often what that vision entails is some sort of transcendent moral cause. It could be making an impact in the world. It can be shifting the dynamic understanding of who matters and who doesn't in culture, lifting up plight of somebody who is suffering or a community of people who are suffering. The trickiest part of this whole book, I'd say, is that you sort of just know moral leadership when you see it, and you know a moral leader when you see that person. And that is both hard for some people to grasp, but also one of the most exciting developments that I think we try to put forward in this book is the idea that, yes, we don't start with a definition and then go seek moral leaders who meet it. We start with people who are sort of just unforgettable, who are admirable, who have some intangible quality. And while that doesn't appeal to folks who like to have a neat list of rules, it also opens up this space for conversation when people do not agree with each other already. They don't have to come up with a common set of rules. They can say, wow, I really admire this person. Hey, me too. Maybe you have completely different reasons for it. Or maybe someone comes close to being admirable but not quite make the cut. You can have a conversation about that, and suddenly you're talking when otherwise you might have been arguing.
Well, and gentlemen, I feel like any time we use the word moral, any time that we're going to have a conversation about morality, we're going to have a conversation about right and wrong. We're going to have a conversation about standards of behavior. And so I think one of the things that I'm curious to know is, are you experiencing what I feel like I'm experiencing in an ever more secular time and in an ever more secular space in terms of the culture? I find it increasingly difficult to come to easy agreement with people with whom I disagree on issues, let's say, on what's going to be the basis of moral decision making. David, I'll let you take that because you talk about this. You know, you talk about this frequently, so I'll let you jump in there.
Yes, thank you. It's a great question. We don't just lack agreement on like moral norms about specific issues like war is moral or immoral or abortion is right or wrong or even what we should eat. I mean, we disagree about everything, but we also disagree about how you know what is right or wrong. So we would call that sources of authority, or epistemology is the fancy word for how we know what we know. And so when you drill all the way down, we disagree over how you know anything about anything, and morality is one of the most complex areas of knowledge, and so our disagreements are especially complex. But the thing that's scary, of course, is it's hard to imagine having a society in which you have no agreement, not just about moral rules, but about how you come to know what moral rules are. But these moral leaders are, I don't know, you might say I've had a long career. This is my 23rd book. And I've written in all different kinds of voices and, we might say, approaches to ethics. But right now, at this moment, studying great moral leaders who people just say, wow, that's admirable. I want to be like that. They really were on to something. This is a way of getting at right and wrong that is kind of a different avenue. And I'm excited about seeing how people react to ethics as biography, ethics as storytelling about great lives.
Friends, we got to take a quick break, but when we come back, I'm going to continue my conversation with David Gushy and Colin Holtz about their new book, Moral Leadership for a Divided Age, 14 People Who Dared to Change Our World. You are listening to Connecting Faith. I'm your host, Carmen LaBerge, and we'll be right back. Welcome back to Connecting Faith. I'm your host, Carmen LaBerge. I am joined in conversation today by David Gushy and Colin Holtz. They have co-authored a book entitled Moral Leadership for a Divided Age, 14 People Who Dared to Change Our World. And it really is 14 short historical biographies that lead us into conversations not only about the ethics of our day, but about moral decision-making in culture writ large. Thank you again, gentlemen, for joining us today on Connecting Faith.
We're so glad you wanted to talk to us about our book. We're excited about it.
So friends can find David online at davidgushy.com. You can also follow him on Twitter at dpgushy. You can follow Colin as well at CD Holtz. So let's talk specifically about some of the stories that are in the book, because I'm with you. I think that narrative storytelling moves hearts and minds today in ways that, frankly, a list of information points does not. And so, Colin, why don't you just pick one of the stories and give us a brief introduction to one of these 14 people?
So I'm going to go with an easy one for me, which is Harriet Tubman. And it's easy because I was talking about her story last night with members of my church who are already using this book as a small group reading material. There's this pivotal moment in Harriet Tubman's life. She escapes from slavery, just this backbreaking, horrible suffering in which she had been grievously wounded, faced the fear of separation from her family for most, you know, the entirety of her life. She finally gets the will to escape. That itself is an amazing story because she's dealing with, you know, what made her brave enough to walk away and crawl through the woods and take all these measures even at a risky time. She, an earlier escape attempt was actually abandoned after her brothers got cold feet, but she kept going. But she has this moment when she finally crosses the border from Maryland, which was at the time a mixed slave state, into Pennsylvania and Philadelphia, and she said, "I'm free." But before too long, she decided, "I have to go back." And that, to me, is sort of the epitome of what we see in a lot of these leaders. She was seeking freedom, and many of these leaders in this book are seeking freedom in some sort of way, but they're also seeking freedom for other people. It's not good enough to just be free and liberated on your own. You want to be free and liberated with your community. And that starts out for Harriet Tubman as her family, and she goes back to try and get her family, and then she keeps going back, eventually trying to include people who are not members of her family but are in a similar situation. And what happens is her circle of moral concern, this community of people for whom she feels ultimately responsible for God, just keeps growing and growing and growing. And the people who have very expansive circles of moral concern, you tend to see them in books like this.
So, David, I would love for you to do the same thing. I would love for you to share the story of one of the people in the book. And I recognize that, you know, each and every one of these individuals, from William Wilberforce all the way to, and I don't want to try to pronounce Malala's last name. So if, David, you'll start with introducing us to Malala in the very last chapter. And then if there's another story in the book that you also want to highlight, I'd love for you to do that. But I was fascinated by the reality that the last person in the book is not only still alive, but still very young.
I think she's 20 or 21. She was shot by Islamist extremists in Pakistan when she was trying to just get an education and had developed a little bit of a reputation for trying to get for Pakistan to be a country in which girls could be educated just like boys. And she was actually shot on a bus, school bus. And, you know, it's just an extraordinary story because, I mean, it's a miracle that she survived. It's a miracle that she got out of the country, got the medical care that she needed. But then, I mean, she... And after a long, you know, period of recovery from her injuries, she ended up emerging pretty quickly as a very eloquent spokeswoman for girls and young women around the world who are denied basic rights, including the ability to get an education. And so now she's in college, and I teach college students as well as seminary students. And I find that teaching about Malala, I just call her Malala, teaching about Malala to people who are her age, they find it extremely inspiring. And it gives them somebody they can identify with in this current moment, somebody they can see on YouTube, you know, and somebody who is just so brave. That's a theme of a lot of these moral leaders is bravery. I mean, they didn't wake up one morning and say, I'm going to be brave. They woke up with a transcendent cause, or gradually evolved for them, and they decided to tackle it. And then the opposition came, including threats of death, but they faced a crossroads and kept going. That's not every single one of our leaders, but that's a lot of the leaders. It's kind of like the journey of vocation, which we talk about a lot in the book. Take one step and take another step, and pretty soon you're risking your life, but you just keep on doing it. You asked for another example. I've been teaching about Dietrich Bonhoeffer for a long time, and students can still continue to be awestruck by his story. And if I had to pick one particular pivot moment for him, it's somewhat similar to Harriet Tubman. It's when in 1939, he had a chance to escape Nazi Germany and to be a refugee teacher at Union Seminary in New York. This was in the summer of 39, right before World War II was started by the Nazis. And he was in New York, and it was extremely rare to be able to get out of Nazi Germany in the summer of 1939. Anybody who could and wanted to and was able to get out, I mean, they stayed out. I'm not aware of anybody else who left and then on grounds of conscience and calling went back. He went back to Nazi Germany to go into the resistance, which he knew would probably take his life. I went to Union Seminary in New York, and there's a room there that is where he stayed. It's called the Bonhoeffer Room. And apparently he was a wreck for about the 4 to 6 weeks that he was there, wrestling in conscience as to whether he should go back. And then he went back, and of course he did go into the resistance and was killed as a resistor right before the end of the war in 1945. It's moments, I think, that where you catch a glimpse of somebody at where they face a really, really excruciating decision, and they make what now we see was the right call, the brave call, that illuminates a lot about what makes somebody an admirable moral leader.
Friends, my conversation partners today are David Gushee and Colin Holtz. The book is Moral Leadership for a Divided Age. It's the stories of 14 people who dared to change our world. Colin, let me pose this question to you and then have David answer it as well. I think that the two of you are self-aware enough to recognize that you write from particular perspectives. You are addressing the conversations of the day, the ethical and moral conversations of the day, from a particular perspective. Not everyone in the culture shares our Christian worldview, and then among Christians, we tend to be very good at slicing it up again. And trying to divide amongst ourselves over and over again. And I think that contributes to the inability of anyone to rise up as a genuine moral leader in the generation today. Now, I am hopeful, as I know you are, that we can inspire this kind of moral leadership in order that we might not continue to be as divided a people as we are on so many things. But I'm wondering, and Colin, I'll pose the question to you first, and then David, you can answer it as well. I'm wondering if you could speak both to progressives who might be listening, who would find offense at some things in the book, and conservative Christians who might be listening, who would find other things offensive in the book. And when I say that, I'm acknowledging that not everybody that you identify is a Christian. And I'm also recognizing that some who you identify are conservative in their Christianity, and neither one of those is necessarily popular among everyone who might lay hold of the book today. So go with that part of the conversation whatever way you want, and just talk directly to the audience.
Yeah, that's a fantastic question. Honestly, I sort of live that question. I came to Christ in my mid-20s. I was working in politics. So a huge portion of my friends are not people who declare as people of faith or Christians, and they're people I've known forever and who are very beloved to me. And so I'm constantly in this question of how do you dialogue? How do you find shared moral norms? How do you find conversation topics that you can discuss and find ways to move the conversation forward and not just fall into heated arguments? And it's really interesting. I think each of these leaders can help us in their own way. You look at somebody like Dr. King. King was a genius at communicating both to his church and to a church audience and to people who were steeped in Christianity, and he could use the Christian story and metaphors and language, and he, as soon as he said a word, they would know what he was talking about. But he can also go around and he can speak in front of a labor audience that may have people of a variety of different faiths in, you know, sitting right there. And he's able to communicate with them by relying on sort of the shared moral norms, justice, freedom that a lot of people hold dear. You can look at Mother Teresa, who we all know of as this saintly, beloved figure. And then we discover in recent scholarship that she really struggled with her faith. She felt like God had gone missing in her life, and that every time she'd pray, she had this crisis of it's not necessarily doubt, because she never doubted, but she felt like God had gone dark for her. It's almost hard to describe. There might be atheists who would feel very compelled by the fact that this woman who was going through this very hard moment never stopped caring for the poor, never stopped being an agent of mercy and tenderness. That's a beautiful story. And so in many ways, some of these leaders can serve as an example for us, no matter what our background is. An easier one might be Oscar Romero, who was just made a saint by the Catholic Church. Pope Francis managed to introduce, you know, one place where the book is out of date before it was even released. He made Oscar Romero a saint 3 days before the book released. But you don't have to be a Catholic to look at Oscar Romero and say, hey, there's something admirable here. You can be a Protestant and not be big on saints and still say, well, this is someone who I admire and I'd like to learn something from.
And David,
I would say if you look at the overall design of the book, we were trying to model some balance and some respect for people who would, in general, be identified as you know, conservative or liberal, to show that there are things to admire about people who are in different places on the spectrum. You might say it is an all-star team. It's not a liberal all-star team. It's not a conservative all-star team. It's not even only a Christian all-star team. It's a human all-star team. And that itself, I think I would say, was intended to be a service in our divided age. So liberals are not as high on Pope John Paul II or Mother Teresa, for example, is very conservative on abortion. And some people didn't admire that too much. So liberals are challenged, but conservatives are challenged, and white people are challenged on issues of race, and Christians are challenged to look at the moral goodness in people who were skeptics or who were of other faiths, like Elie Wiesel or Florence Nightingale or Malala. So, much of my writing has been written from an explicitly Christian perspective only for other Christians. This book, we were aiming at a broader audience, and to kind of like open up our arms and include as many people as possible, both in terms of who we were talking about and who might be able to listen and benefit from the book. It's kind of what we felt was needed in this particular moment in our divided culture.
I think it's an excellent contribution to the conversation. I think you are going to have people stimulated to talk about things that they didn't even know they needed to talk about. And yet the way you tell the stories draws us in such a way that we're compelled to consider, you know, how are the days in which I live like that? Who is suffering in the kind of way that is described here in this story? And why am I not morally outraged? And why am I not doing something? How might I live more simply that someone else might simply live? I mean, I think that the questions that it provokes are really extraordinary. I am looking forward to the conversations that will result from this. I'm looking forward to the next generation person who it's going to inspire. And so to David Gushy and Colin Holtz, thank you not only for joining us today on Connecting Faith, thank you for the book, Moral Leadership for a Divided Age. I look forward to following each of you as the future unfolds and hearing follow-ups as you get feedback on the book.
Well, we'd love to talk to you again in 6 months or a year, see what people are saying about it. But we thank you so much for your, you know, commendation for the book and for having us on your show today.
Well, thank you. Thank you so much. Friends, I got to take one more quick break. When we come back, we'll be making the connecting point. You're listening to Connecting Faith. I'm your host, Carmen LaBerge. God is on the move. This is Connecting Faith. I'm your host, Carmen LaBerge. God's on the move. He's not the only spirit on the move. And today, spiritual forces of the evil one are certainly on the move. And you may be saying to yourself, you know, I'm not sure that there are spiritual forces other than the spirit of the living God. Well, the Bible certainly bears witness to the reality of spirits other than the spirit of the living God. There was a spirit of the world that had gotten into the church in the very first generation. Paul addresses it when he's dealing with the church at Corinth. You know, he talks about the spirit of the world getting in there. We certainly see Jesus dealing directly with evil spirits. Actually, on occasion, they talk to him. Jesus confronts Satan himself in the wilderness, and so we certainly, you know, recognize the existence of spirits other than the spirit of the living God, and so we want to be careful how we give spirits other than the Holy Spirit access to our minds and our lives and our kids, even to our fun, and so. It is Halloween, and you know, I think that we got to be thinking very sober thoughts about how it is that we engage our neighbors on this day. I certainly think it's a great day for us to just open the door, greet our neighbors, and share the savor of the Savior. Help them to taste and see that the Lord is good. And so I think we need to understand what our neighbors are doing when they're celebrating Halloween. What does it actually mean to engage in this very cultural and very pagan practice? The National Retail Federation. Yeah, the National Retail Federation. These are the people who count up what it is we're spending money on, where we're spending it, how we're spending it, and what the trends are over time. So according to this national body of keeping track of what you're spending, what you and I are spending, 160 million Americans, you're saying to yourself, huh, you know, that's half the people in the country. 160 million Americans are going to participate in one way, shape, or form in Halloween. We are going to spend upwards of $9 billion with a B on events related to this day. We're going to spend that money on costumes. We're going to spend it on decorations. We are going to spend it on candy. We are going to spend it on home decor. Some people are going to spend it on travel and lodging because they are going to travel far and wide in order to participate in particular gatherings related to Halloween. I thought that the survey of costumes, what people were going to be wearing, was interesting. Children, number one rank on the list is still the princess. Number two is the superhero. Batman, among superheroes, gets his own billing at number three. And then we have Star Wars characters. And then we have, you know, maybe something that I am not surprised to see on the Halloween list of children's costumes, the witch. If you go to the adult list, the witch tops the list, followed by the vampire and the zombie and the pirate. And so clearly adults have a much darker engagement in terms of what they're wearing in terms of dressing up for Halloween than children do. Princesses and superheroes, Batman, Star Wars characters, and then the witch. Not quite as dark a crowd as the witch, the vampire, the zombie, and the pirate. I also thought it was curious that they list pets. What are pets dressing up as for Halloween? Which occurs to me, pets are not buying their own costumes. Pets are not choosing what to wear. And so I actually find it irrelevant that there would be a list of pet costumes, except to demonstrate that people are actually spending an extraordinary amount of money on costumes for their pets. Why? Well, because for many people, their pets have become like children. So I just, you know, the list of concerns here is long, and you and I could settle in on any number of these things. I think that what will be simply important for us to point out here is that paganism is not in the past. Paganism is very much in the present. And in as much as you want to imagine that the pagan practices that are behind the celebration of Halloween have somehow been set aside and you know, are part of the dustbin of history, and now we've somehow redeemed Halloween, and we just celebrate it as this fun opportunity, you know, to get together with our neighbors and friends. Well, it's still spiritual, and I think that we have to recognize it's still spiritual, and what might have been, you know, some kind of party night with your neighbors is still pagan, and it's important to recognize that. We have talked here on Connecting Faith on prior occasions about the rise in those who are actually practicing witchcraft and Satanism. People are publicly hexing political figures. I mean, there are very dark, very real spiritual practices taking place in America, and paganism is not in the past. It's very much in the present. It's very much commingled today with Christianity. And that's where I want to pause here for just a second and talk about the Day of the Dead. Because for Roman Catholics in the Southwest, the Day of the Dead is actually not just one day. It's actually a series of days. It includes November the 1st and November the 2nd, known as All Saints Day and All Souls Day. And historically, traditionally, the Day of the Dead, celebrated in Mexico and some other places and parts in Central and South America, as a celebration, I would say, I'm going to use that word, of their ancestors. So it's an honoring of dead ancestors. Now, what's really important to note here is it's not Christian. There's nothing about the Day of the Dead that's Christian. We're talking about the pagan practices of ancient civilizations in Mexico and Central and South America, and we're literally talking about the honoring of dead ancestors. We're not talking about the celebration of resurrection to newness of life in Jesus Christ. And so what you need to know is that in the southwestern part of the United States, this is fully commingled with Roman Catholicism. Roman Catholic schools take off days, participate in, and actually host on their campuses Day of the Dead observances. And so I just think that when we imagine to ourselves that paganism is dead, it's not being commingled with Christianity, we're fooling ourselves. And we don't really know the difference between the spirits of this world and the spirits of this age and the spirit of our God. And so I'm going to really encourage everybody to stay very focused in the next few hours and into tomorrow and to the day after. This is Reformation Day. Let us be people who cling without compromise and without question to Jesus Christ as the only way of salvation, to the Bible alone as the Word of God, to the transforming power of His Holy Spirit, and that we would live as people possessed of that Spirit as we encounter the spirits of this world. All right, friends, that's all the time we've got here today on Connecting Faith. Happy Reformation Day. I'll see you right back here tomorrow on All Saints Day. Have a great day, and God bless. Thanks for listening to this conversation from Connecting Faith. These podcasts are available because of listener support. You can make a gift now at myfaithradio.com. And thanks for sharing this audio link with a friend to grow the impact of Connecting Faith. Also, take a moment to subscribe to the podcast today at iTunes or your podcast player and never miss a conversation.